Hey everyone, this is Jeannie, I use she, her pronouns, and you're listening to Sex Talk Happy Hour, a podcast hosted by the New York City Alliance Against Sexual Assault. Is everyone staying cool out there? This summer has been hot and humid, and I don't know about you, but I'm definitely looking forward to the cooler temperatures. Anyway, it's fall, or rather, it's about to be, which for many of us means it's time to start pulling out our favorite jerseys and sporting our team colors, as a bunch of teams are about to start their seasons in the fall. I'll level with you. The only sport I watched growing up was the NFL and the Denver Broncos, but other than my mild obsession with the orange and blue, I'll be honest and admit that I was a total theater and choir kid in high school and know very little about sports. Like, an embarrassingly small amount about sports. Like, I was voted most likely to end up on Broadway as a senior in high school, which also didn't happen, by the way. So, due to my sheer sports ball ignorance, I thought it might be an interesting idea to speak to folks who actually do have some knowledge around this arena. Haha, get it? Arena? Anyway, our first guest today is a former collegiate athlete who currently works for a professional athletic organization. You'll hear which one soon, I guarantee you've heard of it. And our second guest is someone who has and continues to work with athletes at all levels, high school, college, and even professional sports teams, in recognizing behaviors or attitudes that might contribute to violence. I had a lot of fun interviewing these two folks, and I hope that you'll enjoy listening. As always, we encourage you to take care of yourself as you listen, as some topics can be difficult to hear at times for certain folks. Without further ado, here's the first interview with Zach.
My name is Zach Quarles. I am originally from Washington, D.C., currently reside in Harlem, New York right now. As far as career, I work for the National Basketball Association, where I'm part of the Global Intel team, which is under our security department here. And what I do for the department is I provide comprehensive support to our security department through a wide variety of security disciplines. So that can mean physical, personnel, intelligence, investigations, technical, cyber, you name it. And I've been here for about a year and a half now, and couldn't be more excited to, you know, jump into this type of career for this organization straight out of college.
That is so cool. I know that a lot of our listeners are going to be really excited about the fact that I actually got to speak to someone who works at the NBA. All right, so we wanted to interview you today specifically, one, because you do work for an awesome, cool organization, but also we had been introduced to you because of your college experiences. So I wanted to ask you, just in however many words you feel comfortable sharing, can you tell us a little bit about your college experience, including, you know, any sports you played or what kind of organizations you were involved with or anything like that?
So I was recruited by Marist during my senior year of high school, came up for a visit and went to the school, and I just fell in love. I was on the football team at Marist for 4 years. I was an all-conference player and a three-year starter with them and a team captain my senior year there. During that time, I studied political science and pre-law. Thought I was going to go to law school, but that didn't work out. So I'm doing something completely different now. But during that time, outside of athletics and education, I guess you could say, more on the community service side, I was the vice president of athletics for our student government association, as well as the president of our student athlete advisory committee, which is also called SAC. And as far as like community service, I was part of a white ribbon campaign, which is an organization kind of just trying to influence men to be better in the community as far as, you know, addressing topics such as domestic violence, toxic masculinity, etc. And from junior year to my senior years is kind of when I really got heavily involved with the program.
That's awesome. And I think that's especially rare for us to see a male-identified student who plays a very masculine sport, right? What we normally would consider to be a very masculine sport like football. How did you get involved with White Ribbon Campaign and sort of the awareness campaigns around domestic violence and sexual violence?
Well, my athletic advisor, God bless her, she took me to this Grace Smith House Award ceremony back in October 2014. And just sitting there and just seeing the people that were, you know, recognized for the efforts and, you know, the money they donated and, you know, just giving back to the community and seeing how, you know, these women were hearing their experiences, their stories and stuff like that, it really just touched me. And I just kind of thought about how could I bring this experience to our campus. And, you know, I was talking to my athletic advisor and, you know, right away we went into the White Ribbon Campaign. How could that be a way for you to get involved? So my junior year, I was sitting on the panel in front of a bunch of student athletes and, you know, students on campus and coaches, faculty members, etc., and just asking questions. And that was like my first time real experience really talking about the topic without even taking any classes at the time. So I thought that was pretty cool. And then, you know, during that time, a lot of incidents were going on, such as the Baylor University and Vanderbilt incidents that happened with the football teams. And, you know, that just really, you know, inspired me to keep moving forward.
Gotcha. So it sounds like empathy was a big part of your process there.
Absolutely.
When we had spoken earlier, you had mentioned that you were part of MVP, which I know in the athletic world, and I'll level with you and tell you I'm not super athletic, but I know that it usually stands for Most Valuable Player. I know that you took a class also called MVP, but it stood for something else. Could you tell us more about that program, what it stands for, and why you joined that program?
So the main reason why I joined the program, at first I had no idea what it was when my advisor recommended it to me. And then she told me, like, hey, you've been involved in this, you've been involved in this, it's great for you to join this MVP class. So I did some research, and then I looked it up, and it was just about mentors and men and violence prevention. And I was like, wow, this would be cool. It was a one credit course. And when I first walked in the room, I tell you, it was just me and one other male in the room. So that really took me by surprise. But, you know, just hearing everybody's stories and hearing how these women express themselves, it was cool. But what impressed me the most is they were really interested in hearing our side of the story and being honest, you know, how you felt about certain situations and, you know, how men can really play an influence in our community and, you know, what we think can, you know, help influence people, especially young men on campus, to be better when they're out in the social scene, and whether that's walking through campus, whatever it might be. That's really what inspired me. I could tell you, out of all the classes I took at Marist College, that was by far one of the best classes that I took. And it was only about 45 minutes at that. But, you know, every time you go there, I was just really excited just to be there.
Gotcha. So it sounds like the content was really something that really grabbed your attention. And I actually didn't realize that you were already involved with the White Ribbon Campaign before you had joined MVP. So I would have guessed it was the other way around. So it's actually cool that it was sort of backwards, or not backwards, but you know what I mean. So what were some of the main takeaway points, or maybe moments you remember the most from that class, things that resonated with you?
Well, I think there's three main takeaways, and I guess I'll go with the first is the demonstrations and the content that was used during the class. It wasn't just someone sitting up there and just reading off a book. We were engaged in class. We acting out scenarios and, you know, how would you handle this situation if you was in this position, if you was a female or male. So at times we had the male playing the female role and the female playing the male role, which I thought was really, really cool. Another key takeaway I took away from it was the importance of just bystander intervention. You know, understanding that you don't necessarily have to be one of the two parties or whoever might be involved to play a role to prevent a situation that's happening, whether that's in a bar, whether that's in a dorm room, that's on campus. And for my case, you know, the locker room as well, because you hear a lot of stories and stuff like that. And just being able to step up and say, like, hey, you know, I don't think you should say that about somebody, or I think you should handle this a different way. Another key takeaway, I guess I should say, was just what inspired me the most was male influence. And, you know, really understanding the power that we have. You know, I understand as males, we're seen as dominant, we're seen as this, but that's not how I looked at it when I came into the room. And just hearing them say, like, you being an athlete and being a captain of the team, you have the ability to be able to be a voice on the campus and really show people, like, hey, this is how men should carry themselves. And whatever the topic might be, domestic violence, sexual assault, toxic masculinity, relationships, you can name it, so.
That's awesome. I'm really glad that was so resonant with you. Was there anything that you found to be particularly challenging?
Particularly challenging. In the class?
Yeah, in the class, or even things that the class affected in your personal life.
Oh, well, definitely. It definitely had an impact on my personal life. So it was just really just being more aware of my surroundings, especially in the bar scene and going out with friends, whether that was guys, girls, you name it. It really helped me just look at it from a different perspective, sit back and see how people are interacting with each other and stepping in and knowing when somebody is feeling uncomfortable in a certain situation that they're in, because I think a lot of people neglect that when, you know, they're even intoxicated, or even if they're walking through campus and they're sober and they might not think that this is any of their business. Just being able to encourage people to report this to security or talk to somebody about it. Another impact that it really had on me is that I tried to take what I learned from the class and really install it in the young athletes that were on my team and address any situation that I thought was disrespectful in a sense or was just not Marist football. You know, just wasn't Marist football and like how we portrayed ourselves.
Right. How was that received?
You've received a lot of backlash. A lot of times when I'm a captain, I'm addressing the team, nobody really said anything back to me. But what I usually do is just say what I had to say. And if, you know, if people take it a certain way, they might take it a certain way. But I had a lot of people come up to me and say, oh, that was a great, thank you for addressing the team that way, you know, and thank you for, you know, being a role model that we need, that needs to happen on this team. Because a lot of people don't know. They come here and they succumb to peer pressure and just think that they have to be this certain type of guy and be this certain type of male when it comes to talking about females, being around females, and treating females.
Gotcha. So it sounds like you had more of an impact. Maybe they weren't willing to share in a large group, but they were willing to share one-on-one, that you did have an impact on the way they interacted with other people and with women in particular.
Yeah, one-on-one was definitely probably one of the biggest things. I actually had a couple kids that actually came to me and talked to me about, you know, getting more involved in what I was doing on campus. And it didn't already necessarily work out. I know everybody's busy, but, you know, that definitely touched my heart, just hearing that my words, you know, was able to, I guess, motivate them or get through to them in some type of way. So whether they carry that into their own personal lives or they actually actually installed it in the community, that's solely up to them. But that did make me feel good, just hearing the feedback and hearing people saying, like, that was a great way to address the team. You didn't overstep any boundaries. You didn't call anyone out. And I think that's the most important piece, is that you, when you're addressing a team and you're hearing rumors about certain things, that you don't want to call anyone out specifically, because at the end of the day, like, we're all one. And if we have a reputation that says, like, oh, like, this team is acting that way, they are treating women this way, they're talking about women this way, it really affects us in total. And then at the end of the day, it affects every aspect of the community, and especially athletics. And we're already seen as athletes, as outsiders, I guess you should say. So, yeah.
Gotcha. Thank you. Well, what messages from either the messages that you're currently sharing with folks or the ones that you were using when you were back in school, what messages would you want to send to young men on athletic teams in high schools or colleges based on your experiences?
Well, one of them was, I already said, is don't succumb to peer pressure. That's the biggest message that I could send, is when you come in as a freshman and whoever is your mentor at the time, whoever you look up to, your big brother, your big sister, whatever you want to call it, make sure that they have a positive influence in your life. And if they have a negative influence, you know, you need to be able to know right from wrong. We as men and human beings getting to that point to play college, be college athletes, we should know the difference about what's right and what's wrong, and how you should treat somebody and how you should treat others, and et cetera. And just doing that and going by that motto and not taking in that I have to be this type of man, I have to portray this type of masculinity just to fit in, you know, I think that will keep you from making that one mistake that might throw your entire career away or your entire education away. And another message that I would say is, you know, use your status on campus to just be a role model. I know a lot of people, as athletes, we're already looked down upon because we're there, we're on scholarships. You know, a lot of the regular students might think that, hey, you know, they kind of walk around here, you know, on a pedestal. But I think that approach that I think every young male should take is what LeBron said, is don't shut up and dribble. You know, be that idol, be that person that goes out and talk about these things. And what's so cool is that every year when we were doing a white ribbon campaign, every year I saw a better turnout from just regular students on campus that didn't play sports. You know, they would come out and walk around campus with us and partake in these conversations and the stuff that we was doing on campus. And, you know, it's just easy because you walk into the cafeteria, you walk around campus, we all got our red and white on, and we got our athletic gear on. Everyone knows who we are. So if you're carrying yourself the way you should be around people when not everyone is looking, especially your coaches, I think that's most important.
I love that. I couldn't agree more. And I love that message is coming from you as someone who is a former captain of the football team and someone who's working for a very, you know, still a very masculine sporting organization. Zach, this has been such an honor, and I've really, really enjoyed our conversation. Is there anything else that you feel like you really want to share with our listeners?
Only thing I gotta say is just feel free to reach out to you guys or me if you want any advice, or, you know, how did you start off and getting involved in the MVP class, or how you think you can get involved on campus. You know, just go to whoever on campus might be in charge of Title IX training. That's big. Or, you know, just talk to your advisors on campus as well. I think they can lead you in the right direction. If you feel like this is a topic that needs to be addressed on campus, just don't be afraid to speak up.
Thank you so much, Zach. I'm particularly glad that you mentioned a lot about peer pressure, because I do think that we oftentimes forget just how deeply susceptible we are to it, especially when we're in high school or college. Okay, so now that we've heard from Zach, a former captain of the football team, let's now hear from someone who actually works extensively with both collegiate and professional athletic teams on how to address misogyny and gender-based violence.
My name's Eric McGriff, and my pronouns are he, him, his.
Awesome, Eric. I'm so glad that you're here with us today. In as many words as you feel comfortable, would you mind telling us a little bit about your background, education, work, interests, anything else that you think is interesting or worth sharing?
I got into the field of gender-based violence when I was 16 years old, actually, in high school. My twin brother were chosen to be the chairman of a white ribbon campaign as part of my high school's National Honor Society, and we started working with a domestic and sexual violence and elder abuse prevention and intervention agency called Vera House. There, we really just helped run campaigns, we put together panel discussions, and we really started a conversation about what it means to be a man in this work of gender-based violence. How can we be leaders who stand with and behind those who are disproportionately affected by intimate partner violence, and how can we help make sure men are involved in the conversation? We continued that work when we got to Syracuse University. I remember our second week, actually, we did like an Everyday Heroes program where we learned about all the services for people working with people affected by gender-based violence, and one of the groups was a group called A Men's Issue. And after they presented, I hit my brother on the elbow. I'm like, yo, we have to go to that. So week two of Syracuse University, we were in the men's group. And then once we got there, we were connected to all of SU's resources, really. We joined the sex education group called Sex Esteem. We got trained in the Mentors of Violence Prevention program. We started volunteering for Take Back the Night, working with the theater group, E5M, SASE, Students Advocating for Sexual Safety and Empowerment. And we really just dug our hands into the work, which was really cool because we had an opportunity to, build our capacity as facilitators and really start to tease out this idea of what redefining masculinity is. We continued that throughout our college career, and then when we graduated, we actually started working for Vera House, which is the agency we started volunteering for when we were 16 years old. My twin, he started out working full-time with the Enough is Enough legislation, working with the 10 campuses that we had memoranda of understanding with. And then he did a little bit of work with Men Who Batter. I was split on multiple grants. I was working with the Enough is Enough campus stuff. I was working with men incarcerated and newly out of jail or sent from domestic violence court or CPS, who have committed violent crime, mostly domestic violence. I was also working with as young as second grade all the way up to high school, helping schools run clubs, run campaigns, teach multi-day programs using evidence-based curricula in the schools wherever I was needed, doing community presentations, training workers unions, working on Vera House's campaigns, wherever I could fit in. And I worked there for about a year and a half, and now I actually just moved to New York City about 5.5 months ago, and I am the prevention coordinator for the Crime Victims Treatment Center. And I'm mostly working on working with college campuses like I was in Syracuse, but I'm also working with the Healthy Nightlife Initiative, where I am helping nightlife establishments expand their idea of what sexual violence is and what bystander intervention is, so that they can really start to create healthy cultures that have people who know how to prevent and respond to sexual violence when it does happen. Even when it's not, the physical violence that you can just see and know crosses the line. How can you address it beforehand? So that's me, I guess.
Wow. Okay. So I think it's safe to say that you care about this issue. Thank you so much for sharing all that. It sounds like it's really been like a lifelong commitment that both you and it sounds like your brother have made, which is really, really awesome. For our listeners who don't know, could you just share really quickly what the White Ribbon Campaign is?
Yeah, so the White Ribbon Campaign was a campaign that was created because of events that happened at L'École Polytechnique. There was an event where a young man walked onto that campus and he killed 14 female engineers because they were female engineers, and then he killed themselves. A lot of misogynistic rhetoric was being spouted by him, and after that, a campaign was created to engage men in the conversation about where we need to be in standing up against gender-based violence, sexual and relationship violence. So it's an international campaign, and it does a lot of great work to engage men who, you know, a lot of the times are missing from this conversation. And I adore the campaign. I wear the bracelet every single day.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for filling us in on that. So it sounds like, I mean, from high school through college and even with younger students and kids, it sounds like you've done a great deal of work and are continuing to do that work with addressing, you know, how to prevent sexual violence, intimate partner violence. And I'm wondering, in all of that work and all those years that you've been doing this, have you ever had any relationships with student athletes or the athletic departments of anywhere? You know, have you done any work around that world? And if so, would you mind sharing just a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. A lot of the work I do, obviously, is about engaging men. When it comes to engaging men, I think one of the things that can be really helpful is really appealing to or including, you know, ideas of traditional masculinity, so that you can get men involved in the conversation who otherwise wouldn't be having these conversations. And athletics is a great opportunity to do that. So at Syracuse University, yeah, I train the athletics there alongside other volunteers at our advocacy center or students in the Mentors and Violence Prevention Program and the Title IX coordinator. But also when it comes to youth, you know, I've worked with programs like Coaching Boys into Men and Men of Strength Club. My partners in my schools where I was running those programs, those were often, you know, gym teachers or a basketball coach. And we would always use, you know, athletics as a way to entice a lot of the young men who were coming. We'd go to the gym before and after. We'd do a lot of physical activity. And not everyone would want to participate. You could participate to the level that you're comfortable, but we would always create spaces for them to sort of, you know, go out and have fun, play sports, work with the young men that they're with, but also, you know, bring them out to have different kinds of conversations. And I think one of the things that's helpful is that when you're in like a sports atmosphere, there's sort of like this jock insurance that young men can get. And because of that jock insurance, they can sort of let themselves be vulnerable in other ways because their masculinity is sort of compensated for through their athleticism. So I loved working with young men. I've also trained the Phillies, the Major League Baseball team. I've trained professional hockey team. Yeah, I've worked a lot with athletics.
That sounds awesome. I actually really love that concept of jock insurance. I've never heard that before, but it makes a lot of sense that a sense of masculinity wouldn't be compromised because of a sport that they're playing. That actually makes a lot of sense now that I think about it. I know we've been hearing a lot about quote-unquote locker room culture, locker room talk, you know, boys clubs, that, you know, we all those phrases that we've heard. Just in your personal experience and, you know, acknowledging that this would be anecdotal, is that kind of locker room culture something that actually exists?
Yeah, so I think it definitely does exist. But I think one of the things we have to realize is that it is on an individual basis. Not all locker rooms are the same. The culture of each team can be, depending on who's on the team, it can be dependent on who is running the team, the culture that they want to create in the locker room. I've definitely heard, you know, people on the court or people in the athletics field sort of, you know, I guess flexing their hypermasculinity and really, you know, leaning into that misogynistic, objectifying language and using that as a way to sort of bond. But I've also worked with athletic teams that don't do that. One of the things that I did at my last job is we had a Real Men, Real Talk locker room talk edition, and we had a lot of members from Syracuse University's football team in attendance. We probably had about 50 people at this thing. One of the things they were telling us is like, no, that's not our locker room. Our locker room is a sacred space where we can be vulnerable, where we really focus on the team, where we're getting in the headspace, where we're not going to have that kind of conversation there because that's not what that space is for. So I really think it's important for people to understand that, yes, we know locker room talk does exist, and yes, it is a problem. It opened my eyes hearing, you know, from different athletics groups that, you know, that's not, you know, every single team. So I really think it does have to go on an individual basis, but we can still call out that culture.
Yeah, I really appreciate that you saying that, because I do think this sort of general locker room talk or locker room culture is one thing that we're thinking a lot about as a culture right now for the social and political reasons, and also just being able to name that that is actually a sacred. I've never thought about a locker room being a sacred space before because of kind of my own personal biases. So I'm actually really glad that you named that. I know you mentioned you work with college athletics, you've worked with high school athletics and also professional athletics. Did you notice any difference between training, let's say, a professional athletic team versus a college athletic team? If so, would you feel comfortable sharing those?
Yeah, I think there are mostly a lot of similarities based on my experience. You know, they're all very hard to get a hold of. When you're with them for a very limited amount of time. A lot of times it really is a check mark because they have multiple practices in a day. They're on the road. They have to prepare for games. They also have to have time to rest so that they can perform at those games. But when it comes to college athletics, I think there is more support in this kind of work. And I think a lot of that might have to do with a lot of the conversation about sexual assault on college campuses and the ability of, you know, for example, a private institution to implement policies and mandate certain levels of training and engagement for athletes around this kind of issue. So yeah, I definitely think that's one of the bigger differences, more institutional support in my experience working with colleges. And that might just be because of the rise in conversation, the recent legislation that's gone through around this, that's really pushing universities and campuses to be in compliance with the new legislation. And you know, to even, you know, a lot, I find a lot of universities want to go above and beyond just the check mark.
That's good to hear. I am a little surprised to hear that, just because, you know, there definitely has been a focus on college or sexual assault that is happening on college campuses in the past couple of years. I would definitely say that that's true. But I also feel like, and this is anecdotal, I also feel like I've been hearing a lot about professional athletes being accused or held accountable for, or maybe not held accountable for, incidents of domestic violence, dating violence, intimate partner violence, sexual violence. I mean, I'm not going to name any names, but as I'm saying this, I'm sure everyone who's listening is thinking about names that they've heard. And I don't know that I've seen as much of an effort legislatively to support this, you know, that institutional support that you were talking about. I wonder if there's, I guess I'm just surprised to hear that, but also I guess it's easier to implement a campus policy on a campus that exists as opposed to a professional athletic team. So I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think another thing is, like, we are in New York State where they do have, like, the enough is enough legislation, where there are a lot of universities really, really trying to get ahead of this. In my experience, I have a lot of Title IX coordinators who are like, I don't want to hit that checkmark compliance. I want to go above and beyond. That is my goal. And in a place like New York State, where we do have people like myself who are funded to give these presentations, who are funded to offer these trainings that a coach may not have time to, or another Title IX coordinator may not have time to, I think that's an extra, I think that's sort of an advantage. That's something that really helps in terms of engaging college campuses. But I agree with you when it comes to, like, you know, there are a lot of people who get off on these issues, who are not held accountable, whether it's in college athletics or professional athletics. And I think that's a conversation that really needs to be had a lot more.
So I wanted to ask you, because you've mentioned a lot of your work in the past decade or plus has been focusing around engaging men and boys. You mentioned Coaching Boys Into Men, you mentioned MVP, all these kind of programs that focus on the role of men in ending gender-based violence. And I'm just curious if there's a personal reason why that is is such a theme in your personal career.
Yeah, I mean, growing up, I've definitely, you know, been a firsthand witness of a lot of these things. I am a child witness to this kind of stuff, you know, and it starts as young as before I was even in elementary school. You know, my cousin had a breakup with a boy who started to stalk her after, and I didn't understand what it was, but, you know, over the course of years, you know, my cousin would babysit us, and then this guy would come to our house, shut off our power, be on our roof, and, you know, knife marks in the door. And it was really like one of those scary movies you see when the babysitter's home alone. And this happened over the course of years. And that was my first interaction with this kind of stuff. And then I experienced it during my teenage years. And I really just latched on to this campaign, Veerhaus, when the White Ribbon campaign, when it was brought to me. And Veerhaus didn't know what they were doing when they brought this to me. They didn't know the effect that it was having on my life. But, you know, less than 6 months after my twin and I started doing this work, that man that was living with us was out of our house. This work really did change me, and it really made me question masculinity in a way that, you know, taught me what I don't want to be, but also helped me come to terms with my own ideas of masculinity as someone who doesn't really live the life of a traditional masculine man, I guess, if that's okay to say. This work has been really instrumental in changing the life of me, both my brothers, and even my mom. So it really is a huge passion of mine.
Thank you so much for sharing that. That's a really powerful story and a very scary experience, it sounds like. And I can see why this was something that you latched onto early on. And I know you're talking a lot about masculinity, and I want to name, and I'm sure I'm probably speaking for both of us when I say this, that there's nothing wrong with masculinity, but the toxic stuff is what we're worried about, right? And so that is a segue into my sort of last question, which is, you know, in your experience, are there ways to disrupt toxic masculinity, toxic cultures, you know, those locker rooms that are toxic, that are, do kind of fit into that stereotype of what a locker room talk is? You know, who needs to say something? What should they be saying? Can it be disrupted? Any advice around that, that maybe if our young male listeners could benefit from?
Yeah, I think there, you know, ideally it would be a top down and bottoms up approach. You get everyone involved, but that's not always how it happens. In my experience, I often have to find someone who is interested in these topics and sort of help to build their capacity. I think if you want to engage a lot of men in this conversation, you have to look at messaging. You have to validate the lived experiences of men and be able to hold them accountable at the same time. And I think one of the ways that you do that is, one, by having very real conversation, allowing them to be raw and open with everything that they feel. And the other thing is, I think you need to give space for things like storytelling. I don't think that people commit violence because it's what a perfectly healthy person would do. I think a lot of us commit violence because of unresolved cruelty we've experienced. And if you're talking about engaging men, I personally think there's this little t trauma that comes with being socialized in accordance with mainstream masculinity in our culture. I think, you know, when we're stripped from our emotions, when we often have to, you know, to fight and use violence to prove our manhood or to survive, like it has an effect on you. I personally have been made fun of just for telling, you know, my guy friends that I don't want them referring to women as B words. So I understand, you know, how hard it can be and how much courage it takes for men to do this work. And I think that leads us into thinking about, you know, meeting men where they're at. And that's not just accessibility, and that's just not, you know, in their spaces and, you know, meeting them where they're at in terms of their knowledge of this work. But I also think it's about, you know, leveraging their existing talents, skills, and interests, and using those to help mainstream these ideas. You know, I worked with a guy who was a playwright, and he hadn't had these conversations before. And through the work with Beer House, he ended up writing his own play, using his existing talents and interest to mainstream these ideas to an audience that he had context to that we didn't. And I also think that we need to support people through this process. People who commit violence, I think, often have, like I said before, unresolved trauma that they've experienced. And we need to support them and, you know, unraveling and processing all of that. I think we need to support men in this work because there will be growing pains and there will be mistakes that they make. So how can we hold them, you know, accountable, but also recognize that they are trying to do good work and they may not be able to talk about heteropatriarchal hegemonic structures after, you know, their first day. So they're going to do things that may not you know, work out the way that they intended them to. And the last thing I think we need to do is understand that we are in it with them. I, as a man, really do understand the effect of being socialized as a man in our culture. And so I understand that for me, like, as someone who some people might see as an expert, no, I am doing this work every single day. It's a constant negotiation. It's a constant, you know, introspective look at my relationship, you know, to myself and my ideas of mainstream masculinity. It's a look at my relationship to the media I consume and the people I'm interacting with every single day. And I still make mistakes, and I've been doing this work for almost a decade now. So really understanding that I'm not above these people. I'm really in it with them, and I'm doing the work just like they are. And as long as I can validate their experiences, as long as I can give them time to process a lot of this stuff, I think I'm doing what I can to meet them, and grounding it in a sense of empowerment, right? This work about engaging men is not necessarily, it's not all about, you know, holding men accountable and calling out or calling in men to this conversation. It's about creating space for them. It's about empowering them and showing them the ways that a lot of these ideas of mainstream masculinity hold us back.
Yeah, I really appreciate you saying all of that, because I think you're right. A lot of folks tend to have a very knee-jerk reaction around it has to be one or the other, and actually more often than not, it's always both and, right? And I definitely like the idea of calling someone in versus calling someone out, calling someone into the conversation, calling someone into an issue versus just kind of knee-jerk calling out, while I completely understand the urge to call someone out as well, which I do think has its own role in education. But I think it's really interesting to name that men might need spaces for themselves to process through this, and also that not every space has to be theirs too. So that's an interesting thing. I think hopefully our listeners will feel a little challenged by that and have some reflection to do on that, myself included. And yeah, I love that.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jeannie.
Thank you so much, Eric. Full disclosure, I met Eric and his twin at a happy hour in Washington, D.C. a few years ago, and it was basically instant friendship. It's easy to listen to an episode like this and have a lot of mixed feelings. It's especially easy for listeners who identify as men to feel like all the fingers are being pointed at them. So I think it is important to state that most men are nonviolent. I think it's equally important to state that most violent crimes, including sexual and domestic violence, are committed by men, and that most men at some point or another have probably directly or indirectly contributed to the cultures of toxic masculinity and misogyny. Hopefully, certain things in these two interviews provided some helpful tools or tips around how to be better allies in our everyday lives. More than that, I think, in general, we all need to be better at being able to hold two seemingly opposite ideas in the same hand. Like Eric said, we need to learn how to simultaneously keep people accountable for their actions, while also understanding that all of us are simply a product of how we've all been socialized. I know that this is something that I'm working on in my personal life, and so I hope everyone listening today was challenged or heard something that they feel like they can reflect on. I definitely did. Okay, now it's time for our new segment, Let's Talk Sex. This is our newest segment where I ask a question about sex and relationships to a random person and see what they have to say. This week, we have Corey. Hello there, please introduce yourself.
My name is Corey.
Hi, Corey. We're so happy to have you on Let's Talk Sex. All right, so tell me, how have you drawn sexual boundaries in your past? Give us an example.
Setting boundaries is something that is important to me, but I definitely get really nervous at the beginning of a relationship. So it takes me a little time to be more vocal about what I want. But once I do get to that point, and I try to get there as quickly as I can because I want everyone to be on the same page, I try to be just as upfront and honest as I can. So I'm sort of like, if they ask you something, sort of like, I definitely would be willing to try it for you, but it's not my preference. But if that's something you're into, definitely be trying. I'm into trying anything for that person, but I like to set clearer boundaries for myself.
Great. Just a quick follow-up question, because I love where you're going with this. What if someone were to present something that you would like never, like is on your red list, never, don't ever ask me that again? How would you respond to that?
I have been presented with something that is totally on my do not do list, and I think it's super, super important that you make sure that your partner feels comfortable no matter what. Even if it's not something you're interested in, when they ask that, it's a very vulnerable place to be in to ask that. So even if it's on your red list, I think gentleness and compassion with that and understanding, it's like, no, that's not exactly my taste, but like, I don't judge you in any way for feeling that way or for wanting to try that, and it's just not something I'm interested in.
Perfect. I love it. Thank you, Corey.
Yeah.
Thanks, Corey. I loved your answer. Listeners, if you want to be featured on our Let's Talk Sex segment, you can email me at jyoon@svfreenyc.org. I'm not going to spell it out for you here, but I will put it into our episode description so that if you are interested in partaking or participating, you can just shoot me an email there. We hope you enjoyed today's show. And for all of you sports fans out there, I wish you and your teams the best of luck in your upcoming seasons. Thank you to the Alliance staff for supporting this podcast. to Nikki Cruz, our social media expert, to Terry, our communications director, and of course, to Zachary and Eric. We loved having you on this episode. We hope you had a good time too. Remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or Google Play and tell your friends to do the same. We hope to bring you more conversations and we want to hear from you. If you want to get in touch with us, if you have feedback or thoughts, or you have a topic that you want to hear about, you can always tweet at us at NYCAASA or message us on Instagram at NYC Alliance. Make sure you use our hashtag, #SexTalkHappyHour, all one word. Thanks so much for listening. Ciao for now. We'll see you next time.